Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. What follows is part two of the two-part interview we did with bicycle racing legend Fast Freddie Markham. You can find the first installment by visiting our Mountain Movers podcast series found at bikeroute.com. Back when you won the DuPont Prize, the 65-mile-an-hour prize, I guess that was, what, 86? Was that 1986?
May 11th, 1986.
Okay. How many records have you broken since then? Recumbent records, HPV records, do you know?
19.
19 HPV, and how many of them still stand?
I
know Sam Whittington beat you on the overall
speed. At least one. I do believe I still hold top speed in a tandem.
Oh, really?
Well, I do. Yeah. Top speed tandem, 68.9 miles an hour.
Who'd you do that with?
I did that with Chris Springer.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And Chris was an old racing friend of mine through the 70s, and, you know, he actually was fit again. Back in 2000, I think he was an alternate for the Olympic team that year.
Wow.
He was actually rather fit. He's the one that really propelled the thing. I mostly just steered it. I don't think I did anything.
Uh-huh.
But anyways, we did go 68.9, set a world record, and that does stand. Now, the interesting thing about that is it survived an assault by UC Berkeley, who made a tandem bike, and they had these two studly collegiate cyclists out there, and I was pretty sure that thing was going to fall, and they fell short. They went like 68.5 miles an hour, so yeah, I still own that thing and kind of more proud of it every day because,
wow,
I guess it's, well, the only record I got. So.
Wow. When Dick Ryan was flying his doing the Diodolus project, remember that? Over the English Channel?
Yes.
Alan Abbott, I guess?
Paul McCready.
Right, okay, Paul McCready. But he used, I think, didn't he collaborate on some of that with Dick Ryan? Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did. He used some of Dick Ryan's.
Yeah, you could be right about that.
Yeah, yeah. So did you know Alan Abbott?
The kid? I did.
Yeah? Were you at all up for, had they at all approached you about being the guy who set that record?
No, but, of course, Brian Allen went across the English Channel. I think he's the same guy that set the first little, he won the first competition, which was just plain getting the pedal-powered aircraft into the air and flying a measured mile.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first Henry Kramer Prize.
Okay.
The second one, of course, going across the English Channel. The third prize was the solar-powered flight from London to France. That Paul McCready won that one. The fourth Henry Kramer Prize was one I did go after. They approached me to ride a pedal their plane called the Bionic Bat, which looked an awful lot like the Gossamer Albatross, the one. Mm-hmm. One that went across the English Channel, except
right.
It was a little sturdier, and it was meant for a little faster flight. At this point, they decided you could use some battery, you could use electrical power to assist some of the flight controls and the power of the plane, but you had to charge the batteries yourself. This is where I found out they needed a racing cyclist, because it was actually hard to charge the batteries, and they gave you 10 minutes. And they gave you 10 minutes to charge the batteries. About 8.5 minutes it took me to put enough charge for about maybe a 2 to 3 minute flight. And I had to hook the propeller back up. So at the end of 10 minutes, the clock starts ticking on your flight, more or less. So you really want to get in the air as quick as possible. I practiced it. I did it. I took flying lessons, practiced mostly takeoffs, landing, stalls, flew the plane a little bit, made some runs, and then MIT ended up winning the prize, actually, before we ever really made an official attempt.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And never really got another shot at it after that, but it was, I will say this, I learned a lot. I mean, learned how to fly, which was pretty cool. But I do remember the morning I walked up to get into the Bionic Bat. It was like about 4:30 in the morning down in like Bakersfield, California. You do it because there's no wind. And as I was climbing into the Bionic Bat, and I was sitting down and you know, looking at the controls, I was finally thinking to myself, it was like, gulp, you really did it this time, you know? It was like, what? Because it was really different. You know, of course, on an airplane, you know, your rudders are on the floor. Well, you know, so that's how you practice. Well, since you have to pedal, they're up on the control stick. And it did this kind of goofy little, you know, push-pull thing. And so it was, you know, I'm already dealing with flight in general, and then I had to go change, you know, the flight controls just like that. And it was kind of a stressful moment, actually, but it was a heck of an opportunity. I wish I could have done something more for Paul. He's just an amazing and just inventor. I mean, he's like almost like, you know, way out of here. He's like way smart.
So what I'm trying to, I don't know if maybe I missed something here. Did you ever get that thing in the air? You personally? Were you in the air?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
How high up would you get? 200 feet?
Like 20 feet. Not even, no. Yeah, because, you know, it really, we do it, fly at the length of the runway, and so you just get it up, you know, and the thing was only really going, you know, you're talking, you can get airborne on the thing with about 5 knots, 6 knots.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'd get it up, and then you'd just, you know, get it airborne, and then, you know, kind of play with the controls there, you know, bank left, right, and go the length of the runway, set it down, a couple of guys steady it, turn it around, you know, and then fly it back in the other direction. And, you know, so that's...
Wow. Wow. All this opportunity from being a champion and recumbent cyclist.
You never know what you're going to do next.
Right. Well, you know, just want to, like, just so you can hedge your own bets from when you and Gardner ended up on the outs, which, you know, by the way, I know from my own experience wasn't a hard place to end up in. When you weren't working for him, building Easy Racers, you got a career installing cable. You also work for Calfee Design, helping them make a recumbent. Tell us about that experience or that bike in just a few short sentences, if you will. Or can
well,
you do
it wasn't
that?
The bike. Yeah, the Calfee Stiletto, it was, really wasn't the bike I was hoping for, to say the least. You know, I had a number of issues with Calfee that ended up up and you know what, when in 2001 I went back to work for Gardner after and it was telephone splicing I do, not cable.
Okay, I'm sorry.
After pretty much after 9/11, you know, our the tech sector died, you know, so Gardner was nice enough to kind of give me a spot again. Well, I worked for him for about, you know, a year, and that space of time we had some ideas, you know, I was going to do some specific things. And in the end, I couldn't seem to get any of them going. You know, just felt that, gosh, you know what? I wanted to move on. I wanted to do a carbon fiber bike. And so I left to do one. Craig Calfee happened to be right in town. You know, he's on the other end of Santa Cruz. So, you know, look, I went there first. Maybe it was a lazy... In a sense, it was lazy. I probably should have looked around a little more. But, you know... He seemed like I had already raced his, you know, his carbon frames in the past, and I loved them. I mean, they were sweet. So I had no reason to think that this would work.
Okay,
and,
now let's qualify that. He has carbon uprights, just so people know. He made a road frame.
Yeah, it's a pretty sweet bike. He really was. So that's where I knew him, and I already had the little rapport. He's in town, so we went over there, convinced him to make a carbon fiber Gold Rush, more or less, you know, get in there, let's, you know, make a carbon fiber bike. And well, it pretty much degenerated down the tubes. But I will say, you know, and it was one of those things where I you know, I learned enough there to help me down the road further. I made some contacts there that really helped me today. You know, it's one of those deals where you look and you think, oh, what a waste of a year of my life for more. And, like, you know, and nothing came. I can't say that. You know, it was, it was sure certainly a disappointment. But you know what? In the end, it probably was. It's just what it was is what it was. I've moved on, and I think I'm better off for it. I truly am.
So, Freddie, do your road friends respect recumbents as being fast?
They are fast. I just don't think most of them realize it. That's why I take it out from time to time to let them know and, come up against them. You know, in Santa Cruz, it's a little tougher to be competitive because, face it, they usually are not as fast uphill. Biggest reason why, if a hill gets to the point where you ever really want to get out of the saddle, and get that extra bit of torque and stuff, you can't do that on a recumbent. You're forced to really sit down and spin. So you have to get real comfortable with that position. And when you do, you'll find that a recumbent, no, it won't climb as fast as a road bike. But it will probably climb, if you're good enough, you'll crest the hill close enough to them that somewhere on the downhill you'll just simply blow by them. And, depending on if you have another climb or not, you might or might not see them again. It's all the battles in the terrain you pick and choose on a recumbent to show whether they are good or not. But they certainly are capable of some really amazing things. A guy on another recumbent last year won the race across Florida. I think it's a 165-mile road race. It's an open road race. Roadies against anything. There are several recumbents on there, and there's pace lines and all kinds of. It's a race, basically. May as well be. And he won it on a recumbent. It shows that, for a guy that was, I think he was 48, 49 years old at the time when he did that. I mean, it's kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when I used to come out to Freedom, to Watsonville, and you guys used to do those roll-down tests on, what was that, White Road, or what was that road you guys would test the roll-down?
Rampart. Is a very steep road here, not far from the factory.
Okay, and I would always I'd make mention of the fact that recumbents don't climb as well, and Gardner would always poop. It's always the recumbent. Depends on the recumbent. No. And let me show you. Look, Freddie, let's show them. And you guys would no doubt always smoke me. Because I'd be on the end of the seat steered version, but. I think what you've finally admitted is that recumbents, no matter what type of recumbent steering configuration, they're going to be a little bit slower uphill.
Yeah. You're carrying more weight uphill. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that. The standard, gosh, everybody's got a sub-20-pound road bike nowadays, it seems like. That's very common. The bike guy was probably rolling around back then in standard Gold Rush with the carbon fiber fairing and, body stock. That's still probably, that rolling bike down the road was still probably 28 pounds. Mm-hmm. Gosh, maybe it was pushing 30. I don't know.
Easy, yeah.
It's a good thing it was way aero. So, especially in the rolly hills and the flats and anything that resembles downhill, it owns a road bike. When you start adding some long, certainly steep climbs, it's not in its element. It's not in its element for competing against a road bike, but you can certainly go up the hills and have a good time, if you're not trying to keep up with Lance or something.
Speaking of which, I didn't really cover that. You've seen both those guys race. You saw Lance as a junior, way junior. You saw Greg LeMond when he was more in his prime. If you were to go ahead, those two were to go head up, who would be the stronger of the two?
Yeah, well, interesting. And then do we compare the early Lance or the later Lance? They're similar in a. They're similar in a sense that they were both. I suppose I would give the edge to Lance and say, Lance would probably do it. But Greg was a very phenomenal person too. They just don't fatigue. They both had you know, just probably incredible tolerances for pain. I've told you the story basically as we know it. Lance doesn't really secrete lactic acid, though. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe only in a full sprint when it's just, you know, but that guy can plug along at usually higher heart rates and more wattage output than the next guy and produce less lactic acid. Well, gosh, I might have been able to win 7 tours if my body didn't produce lactic acid too. So, probably not. But the point is, I think Lance has the edge in that department. But you have to look at how multiple Tour de France champions are. I think genetic freaks to a point. They got something going for them that really nobody else does. You know.
So Le Mans was capable of winning a couple more tours, you say?
I believe so. Yeah. I think he certainly gave one up in the year post when he was, you know, he took his shotgun blast. You know, he lost one there. And, of course, he was probably denied what would have been his first one in 1985 when, you know, he was told to let up and, you know, basically let Hino win.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you never know. You do never know, but it sounds like he was capable of minimum of 4, and then, you know, at that point, why not 5?
Le Mans was
a special racer.
Was Boyer in their league at all?
If you could finish a Tour de France, you're in a pretty high league. Was he in their league? Apparently not, because he didn't win one. And I would have to put Tour de France winners on a higher pedestal than Tour de France competitors, and I put them on a higher level than pretty much everybody else. So I guess not. But,
okay,
I'm going to tell you something. For a guy like me who would go up against them in a professional U.S. race somewhere, and you would have happened to probably had somebody like Lance LeMond or Boyer trading pulls with you, you probably really wouldn't notice. You know, where you would notice is in the final miles of that race when they kind of up it a notch, and you know, this is where they start to really crack you. You know, late in the you know, on the high mileage events, those final hours, those final times, that's where most pros just break it loose.
So, when you say Boyer didn't win a tour, might he have won a tour if he would have had a better team?
I'm sorry, one more time?
Might he have won a tour if he had had a better team, Boyer?
You know, I'm hard-pressed to say that because I off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly where he was placing in the tour anyways. And okay. I think you don't have a chance to win the overall if you can't snag a few stage wins along the way. That's probably you don't have to, but you certainly have to start getting on the podiums. I don't recall that. So, no, I think even with a better team, what would have happened was you might have ended up with other teammates maybe doing better than him, you know. As I recall, I think he was the domestique for his teams. I could be wrong on that, but,
he raced for the French, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wrapping up, getting toward the end of all this, Freddie. This has been an incredible interview. Now, as the president, as the owner, as the CEO of Easy Racers, what do you say to people who say that recumbents are people who can't ride a road bike? They're more for the middle-aged crowd. How do you address that, being the speed merchant that you are?
Well, that could be the million-dollar question, to be honest with you. They may not be for everybody, but then neither is a mountain bike, and neither is a racing road bike. You know, in the end, I think I'd like to see everybody on bikes at some point. I've always found it really ironic that one bikie would look at another one and poke fun at his bike. This usually coming from a crowd that usually is like, if it feels good, do it. You know, I mean, anything goes. It's like, you know, don't let's not, you know, poke fun at anybody. But when it comes to you're riding a bike like that, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. It reminds me of it. There was a brief period of time I was on the Olympic team. You know, there was the road bike guys versus the track bike guys. We were fighting amongst ourselves. We didn't realize that we needed to stick together as a whole if we wanted to even get further and yank more money out of what was the United States Olympic Committee.
Right.
But now it was easier to fight amongst ourselves. Well, you know, cyclists just have to embrace whatever kind of cycle a person just happens to be on. You know, maybe I need to learn that as much as anybody, but there could be a time and a place for a lot of people. I will say that recumbents have put a lot of people who were avid cyclists for one reason or another, couldn't ride, put back on the bike again. And you know what? They're happy. And, you know, in the early years, I used to have this always joke. It's like everybody that walked on an easy racer, gosh, seems like in the early 80s, was like, well, what's your handicap? You know, I mean, come on, I know you got one, you know. And, but suddenly that stops around. You know, you got normal people walking in now, you know, normal, healthy guys. And the demographics are coming down. And I think if somebody really takes a good hard look at some of the recumbents that are out there now, a lot of them gotten better looking. And, you know, they're capable of some pretty amazing performance figures. Not all. You know, you got to choose wisely, and certainly I think Easy Racers leads the squad. But I think a lot of people who will hear this, I'll never ride a recumbent, they may be faced with some issue down the road that forces them off of a road bike for a number of reasons. They won't be able to put the time, effort in, or have the pain-free ride anymore. And there's just a better way. You know, it doesn't have to be. So, yeah, you know, but besides that, you know what, there's a lot of merit to them. They're not going away. Right now, it's the pretty much only growing segment of cycling. And though it's yet small, like I say, it's growing, and I think you're going to see quite a few more on it because, you know, it's, I think, let's face it, as people get older, it'd be nice to have to sort of settle down on. And you don't have to be older to have fun on one, but, you know, that's just the way it is. It's possible, so. Now, really, regardless of your health issue, you ought to be able to pedal the day you die, and at least in comfort.
Right on. You know, Freddie, back in back in the early 80s when I used to come out to the chicken coop when Gardner was building recumbents in that chicken coop on reconverted chicken coop on Freedom Boulevard.
Right.
I used to kind of have that sense that here I was 32 years old and I was riding a recumbent and I totally was a square peg in a round hole because most of the guys who were riding recumbents were almost, I couldn't think of anybody. Nobody was riding them in 83 for one, but I was totally the odd duck, you know, because I was riding one, and I always had the feeling that Gardner was looking at me like, maybe you're still handicapped from your head injury or something like that. and so I always had that to work against myself, but I'm glad to see and hear and know that you know that it's changing. It's not the bike for the person who's got some debilitation in one way form or another. And I'm happy to hear that. Well, we've reached that point where we've got to start wrapping up. Anything you'd like to add at this point, Guy?
No, I don't. I just, thanks for the time to talk. And, it seems like, since I became president of Easy Racers, it seems like my whole life has come in order. Suddenly everything is clear, every pedal stroke, you know, every scratch, scrape, burn, sweat, and all that stuff. You've got 30 years of cycling knowledge, and at one point I was wondering what the heck I was going to do with all that. So I'm just happy to pretty much spread it here, and this is where I'll be for a good long time, I hope.
All right, Freddie. What a treat. This has been an honor. This is definitely very important podcast. I think this is legendary, if you will. And I thank you for taking the time for us today, Guy.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
All right. Okay, Freddie, thanks for you, man.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Bye, Freddie.
Okay, bye-bye.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenways Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. For more info about the NBG, go to nationalbicyclegreenway.com. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.